Hello and welcome to CanQueer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
And we are excited to bring you another week of Canadian queer news.
Very excited.
This week is a bit of a special week because I got to speak with Andrea Wilson, the executive director of the Inside Out movie festival.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the biggest and oldest one being in Montreal. That's not Inside Out. Inside Out is based in Toronto.
Right.
And they have a screening. But they have some really great initiatives. They're looking at sort of licensing these great films so that you can screen them anywhere.
Okay.
Really making them accessible to communities up and down Canada, which is really exciting. And that's sort of where we zero in our discussion. But before we talk about all that, I went and saw Fruit Machine, the documentary, and we both watched Rafiki. Unfortunately, we didn't have time to review a couple of the other Canadian, well, Rafiki is not Canadian, but we didn't have time to review the other Canadian gay movies.
I mean, you did, but I was bedridden with the flu.
And even if we did have time, there's just not enough time in this episode to tell everybody about them.
So there's also that.
We're a bit tight. Now, I was tipped off by some sources out in BC, some folks who are keen listeners of this show, and my shout out to them. Okay, I'm gonna preface this, and it may have a ring of familiarity about it.
Okie dokie, go on.
There is a gay man,
all right,
who's in charge of an arts and heritage organization.
None of this surprises me.
I know, so far you are shocked to the core. Now, this is a gay man who maybe he ate too many rainbow sprinkles as a child. Right. I don't know. But he doesn't find women attractive. That's just a thing that is where it is.
That is his way.
Yeah. So far, I'm not really sure how much of this is news.
Not really.
That somebody in the arts culture is, first of all, gay, and that being a gay man means they're not totally into women.
Right.
I feel like for the second week in the row, I am telling our listeners, why is this even news? And, you know, before the punchline drops. Last week, we were talking about the Edmonton Oilers stadium with that sort of the lady who, like Usher, who was so shocked that there was a lady kiss doing a White Stripes performance. And,
yes.
You know, and it was like, it's 2018, it's the White Stripes, it's Edmonton. Like,
yeah, the story was basically, and the manager said, oh God, I'm so embarrassed, I don't know how this happened.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And we're in Canada in 2018 going like, how does this become a news?
Most of the news stories these days, it's the first 30 seconds where you're like, ooh, and then like 5 minutes of, oh, okay, they reacted correctly.
So this gay man,
right,
who is in charge of an arts and heritage organization in Chilliwack,
okay,
lovely place. So this guy is being blackmailed,
right,
for being gay.
Okay.
By a media personality.
Okay.
Somebody who really ought to know better.
Right.
And it's not like one of those crazy radical right-wing papers either. It's not like, you know, crazy media out of the States.
So basically, somebody was going to blackmail him, and he just went, and decided to sit on it until the guy went public to be like, girl, I came out when I was 16. What's your problem?
I so wish that was the case.
Aww.
The guy's called it out. He's okay. Like, so-and-so at such a media distributor is trying to blackmail me. Essentially, somebody in Chilliwack believes that because somebody is gay, that's grounds for them to apply leverage and pressure and try and ruin someone's career.
Okie dokie.
Now, we were asked by the victim in this case not to name names. Not to give the person attempting the blackmail the time of day.
Right, yeah, yeah.
You know, well, why say their name on air?
There's a lot of reporters who won't give the name of mass shooters or serial killers because they don't want to glorify.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I probably wouldn't have discussed it, but I've been thinking about it the last couple of days. And what really annoys me is that, you know, this is going back to that story of how is this even news?
Right, yes.
How is there somebody in Chilliwack who believes that just because somebody is gay, i.e. they fell in love with somebody of the same sex, that they believe that they can use that to leverage them and put their job at risk. And, you know, in this scenario, it's...
And leverage them for what? If they're the head of an arts council, what are they going to... Are they looking for, like, free oil paintings? Like, what are you going to leverage them to get out of them?
I don't know. We don't know the details of what the blackmail like, intended goal was.
Again, not to belittle the victim in question. I mean, I'm a very big fan of the arts, and I think people who are involved in it are very important. I'm just not entirely sure what they wanted from this person. Like, I'm just... What were they trying to get?
But going through that track, like going about it that way is despicable. It is shameful.
It's like 30 years out of date.
It's it's so passé. Like, oh my God, that particular type of blackmail is so last season.
It is.
But I say that and we jest, but this is extremely important. And like I said, I would not have raised it had it not been for the fact that a couple of months ago, we were talking about the mayor of Cape Breton, who, when he was trying to run for the Conservative Party leadership in Newfoundland,
right,
was being blackmailed for being gay, right, and had to out himself.
Right.
Like, apparently, there are Canadians out there who feel that just because somebody goes to bed with somebody of the same gender, that that's grounds to manipulate them, to try and force them to do or not do things that they feel is of value to them.
Well, I mean, the way that blackmail works is that anything you keep a secret is grounds for blackmail. I mean, it could be that you don't know how to drive, and then you're an elected official, and, you know, someone's going to leak that you're a 54-year-old middle-aged woman who never learned how to drive, and that's so embarrassing, and how could you possibly run a district or whatever? And then, like,
the Ministry of Transportation.
Ministry of Transportation. And if you're that person, and you're just like, tell you what, I'll race you to the media, all right? Mm-hmm. You and me, we'll see who gets there first. Like, that's the response, that you can only blackmail someone for something that they're embarrassed about. In fact, as Canadian society, it now protects people who are in the LGBTQ spectrum. And so, I mean, this does pose a problem for people who are not out. If you are closeted for whatever reason, there are reasons to stay in the closet, which is kind of awkward, but I have spoken to people, and when they tell me their context, I'm like, oh, maybe you should delay coming out for 5 or 6 mm-hmm. years. It's not ideal, but this is the least worst option. But by and large, modern Canada, there's nothing to worry about. And the fact that this guy thought that he could
get away with it.
Well, and also the head of an arts council.
Then it would even work.
It would be like blackmailing a ballet dancer, you know? Just, you know, everyone thinks you're gay. It's like, well, I'm sorry to surprise you, but,
yeah,
you know, those hips
and
don't
that's
lie.
That's why I wanted to specify arts and culture organization. I won't say which one, but it's like, this is a field where there's been a comfortable, you know, people are comfortable with homosexuals in there.
Absolutely. I mean, Mae West, the first sex symbol of cinema, the first female sex symbol of cinema, in 1902, I think she wrote a play featuring drag queens. It was a play about drag queens that got shut down during the first act. It's the only play in history to get shut down before the first act was closed on opening night. It's kind of legendary. But anyway, like, the whole play was about the fact that gay men are secretly running around helping to keep the arts alive. And this was in like 1902. And it was just, you know, if it's not the one doing your makeup, it's the one pointing the light at you, that they're everywhere. So maybe, you know, if you have religious misgivings, whatever. But if you're in the arts, you got to get used to it.
Well, this individual who's attempted the blackmail was, or allegedly attempted the blackmail, is a media personality. We won't go into it any more than that. But I was just shocked that in Canada in 2018, that people still think that would work. Okay, so I want to move on quickly to our next topic. Now, in Alberta, Premier Richard Notley is trying to put some pressure on the Conservative Party there.
Okay.
Because the Conservative Party, and Jason Kenney, who's the Conservative Party leader, has apparently said, we won't abide by extremists in the Conservative Party. And you're probably thinking, this is all reasonable.
That seems fair.
Very reasonable.
I'm into that.
And Richard Notley is like, oh, we found one. What are you going to do about it? And I'm clearly paraphrasing. I don't think I don't think that's like Richard Notley's press statement is, what you're going to do about it. But what's really interesting here is that the Justice for Constitutional Reform, I think it is, was founded by a gentleman, a lawyer called John Carpe.
Okay.
Now, this individual has very much been thrown into the limelight over the last couple of days. Now, this is the same lawyer. So it's the same lawyer who, speaking at the Rebel Live event, the Rebel Media being a sort of right of center media organization.
Right of center to right wing, depending on who's writing.
Yeah.
So like half the time
I was being polite.
Yeah. Well, it's like 1 in 10 times I hear someone from Rebel Media speaking and I'm like, you know, I don't agree with that, but I understand the sentiment. And the other 9 times out of 10, I'm like, oh, like just huge facepalm. What are you doing?
But, so he was speaking at this event and apparently had compared the rainbow flag to a Nazi swastika.
Specifically a Nazi swastika. Because here's the thing about the swastika. It's originally a Buddhist symbol for enlightenment, unity, and peace. So, I mean, if you want to say the rainbow flag is like the swastika, I mean, I guess so, depending on how we're defining it. But specifically the Nazi? I mean, what? Just what?
Okay, in the recording that we have, which I'm about to play right now, which is really what got him into hot water.
Mm-hmm.
How do we defeat today's totalitarianism? Right? Because again, you got to think about the common characteristics. It doesn't matter whether it's a hammer and sickle for communism, or whether it's the swastika for Nazi Germany, or whether it's a rainbow flag. The underlying thing is a hostility towards individual freedoms. The underlying thing is a vision where government is the master, and government is forcibly guiding us towards this wonderful utopia, rather than allowing us to exercise our freedoms and raise our families and lead our own lives.
I mean, really, there's no if and no buts. There is a clear, clear comparison to Nazi Germany, the USSR, and gay rights.
Right.
Because I don't remember the gay rights running a gulag. You know what I mean? And Nazi Germany rounded up and killed a lot of gay people.
And the thing is, I mean, I think I know what he's trying to say, because I have met activists within the community, and I put activists between air quotes here, who have some really weird ideas about what the government should do and how the community should react. But the rest of the community is like, they're not with us.
Because a lot of this talk is like, oh, how, you know, the state is telling us what we can say and what we can't say, and it's all totalitarianism and there's no freedom anymore. And it's, well, no.
I mean, it kind of sounds like the early 2000s where people were saying, if we allow same-sex marriage, I will have to divorce my wife. To which everyone said, what?
Why?
How does the one lead to the other? Or like,
is your wife really, really into another woman and they want to get married? And sort of facilitate that? You know, just, I don't know. So
weird.
Not only was there the rainbow flags at Nazi Germany comparison by this particular gentleman.
Yeah.
It just got leaked a fundraising letter from the Justice for Constitutional Freedom organization. And in this letter, they compare gay straight alliances to spaces that would be used by predators, abusers, and bullies to exploit children.
Ooh.
Now, I'm going to take a quick step back here. They take issue with the bill around GSAs because it does... Parents are not automatically informed when their child signs up to a gay straight alliance. Now, I want to...
Because ostensibly half of the members... I mean, if the organization is well run, half the members should be straight to help develop a healthy environment where people can actually like communicate with people who are different from themselves. Yeah. Like, that's part of the original intent.
Gay straight alliances.
Yeah. So, I mean, telling the parents that your kid is in the gay straight alliance, it could be that their best friend is gay and they're there to support them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, telling the parents does nothing.
And then what happens? You end up in conversion therapy, for example, because that's still a thing that happens. I mean, it boggles the mind. I mean, as a LGBT media, maybe we are rooted in that kind of perspective of like, how could we do it?
Yeah.
But we have to look at the evidence here that homelessness is disproportionately queer youth. And that is because there are queer youth's parents who are kicking them to the curb.
Yeah.
And I don't think that forcibly outing every single one of them across the whole province of Alberta will help.
Yeah.
And so for me, that issue is ridiculous to begin with.
For sure.
But at the same time, it's like, how do you balance the right to the parents? You know, I understand the
parents
the intellectual want to know, complexity,
they
can,
they want to help them, they want to protect them. Like, there are parents who would be angry that the school didn't tell them, not because they're homophobic, but because they're gay positive. And they're like, I came out to my parents when I was like 20, but it turns out that I'm the only non-bisexual in my family, and I could have come out at like 10.
But this is another thing that's queer, is that who you tell, when you tell, is yours. That is your identity. It is fundamentally the one thing that you can decide.
Yes.
If you want to better understand this, I would suggest watching Love, Simon, because it is a very good film for a straight audience.
Okay.
Like, it's like a white middle school, very family friendly, straight audience gay film. Love, Simon.
Like,
it's very good.
Like Brokeback Mountain, but less depressing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and it moves a lot quicker. The plot line is much better.
There's a lot of people who only started appreciating the queer experience after watching Brokeback Mountain, which is a bit sad, but you know.
Yeah, that's really depressing.
At least they got there in the end. Well, that's the way that I see it. Talking about
queer media representation of LGBT folks, we're going to jump into our first interview. This is with the interview I did with Andrea Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, we'll have a song by Callum Scott, who is obviously openly gay as well. And the song is No Matter What. So we're going to do Callum Scott's No Matter What and then the interview with Andrea Wilson. And we'll be back right at the end of the show after the other interviews.
Excellent.
Hi, I'm here with Andrea Wilson, the executive director of the Inside Out Film Festival for the Ottawa Film Festival. And as always, it's an exciting weekend. Everyone gets super motivated to come and see these incredible movies. And before we talk about the movies, because queer films have been all over the news. We've mentioned them multiple times in our shows, including Rafiki, which super exciting you got that. I wanted to touch base about some of the initiatives that you're launching. So the one that's really interesting to me is about your initiative to kind of engage local communities to create their own sort of mini screenings and just get-togethers to share in this wonderful content. Because we're here in Ottawa, even our Ottawa audience, by the time they hear it, it'll be too late. And, you know, the Toronto Film Festival for the Inside Out Film Festival is always a destination to go to. But for some folks, maybe in Vancouver or in Bonnie Bay, that's not always super reasonable a thing to do. So are you able to tell us a bit about the initiatives that Inside Out are taking to kind of address that sort of urban-rural divide that we might see?
Absolutely. Well, you know, one of the things that we really have started talking about in the last few years is, you know, how can we really utilize the changing distribution picture for film to our advantage in terms of creating more opportunities to get films in the hands of folks who, like you say, may not be able to make the trek to Toronto or to Ottawa to catch the film festival. So in 2019, we're launching an online resource, which is going to be a hub through our website, a database built of short and feature films that we have licensed for educational and community usage. So the whole idea is the site will be available to folks all across Canada, and they will be able to create an account, go in, and book screenings of these films completely free of charge to host in their own communities. So the idea is not to create, you know, yet another streaming service where folks can be, you know, at home in their living room watching this content, but where they're actually able to create their own space, you know, to screen these films and share them with their communities. Like, we recognize the amazing work of community organizers across Canada. It's really incredible what's happening in some of these rural spaces. And so often the challenge is, you know, they might have all the capacity to host a screening, but may not have the access to the film itself or to know how to go about booking a film. So this is kind of taking away that, you know, gatekeeping or, you know, that question mark about dealing with a distributor or how do you get a film, and just simply using our website to do it.
Well, it's interesting you say that because we spoke a few weeks ago about Fierté Canada Pride, and they had their big report. And we know for a fact that across the whole world there's around 1,100 Pride festivals, and 120 of them are across communities in Canada. You know, can you see folks who maybe have a festival in Banff or in, I could pick like Fredericton, New Brunswick, for example, in these smaller communities that still big enough to have a Pride festival, maybe introducing this into their lineup of events, sort of addressing culture as part of their celebrations.
It's really interesting. Just a couple of weeks ago, we hosted an event in Toronto where we brought in representatives from organizations that present queer cultural work, you know, whether it's film or theater, dance, music, from all across Canada. And one thing I was so struck by is that we all have very specific challenges related to our own communities, of course, but we also have so many common challenges that we all face in these different markets. And a huge area of challenge for many folks is just access. So we love the idea of having a strategic approach to just being able to provide content where, it takes out that guesswork of how would I find this work? How do I, you know, if I want to really connect with certain diverse communities within the LGBTQ community, how do I find that content? So to really improve that process. And in terms of the Pride festivals, I think, you know, there's incredible opportunity for partnerships there. And I think that it's something that as we grow and we examine the role of LGBT film festivals, the role of Pride organizations in 2018 and beyond, I think exploring partnerships is a great way to really move forward together.
Now, a lot of that is important that as Canadians we see ourselves reflected in the work that we see. And we are seeing a golden era of LGBTQ plus representation. There's ever increasing representation in various things. I remember that last year you played God's Own Country here in Ottawa, which is now on Netflix. You know, what role do you think that the festivals such as yours play in pushing some of these films into the mainstream onto platforms like Netflix?
Well, you know, God's Own Country is a great example. That was, you know, one of our favorite films of the year. Last year we had the North American premiere. We opened our Toronto Festival with that film. And it went on to then really be the opening film of countless, you know, both LGBT and mainstream festivals. Went on to be nominated for a BAFTA, won, you know, British Independent Film Award. And that was such an incredible example for us of also, you know, that film is made by a gay writer director, you know, so that was such a beautiful thing for us to be able to be a part of, and to be able to see not just the queer content, but the queer creator really getting this platform through the showcasing and Inside Out, and then from that, you know, going on to bring the film to all these other spaces. And in terms of, you know, the online platforms, you know, Netflix and Amazon, etc., I think we're incredibly proud when the films get to the point where they're being seen by that many viewers. You know, Netflix just released some numbers, and some of their originals in this past quarter, they're tracking 80 million viewers, you know, with so much independent film. We think of our wildest dreams of how many people would see an independent film in its lifetime, and now that's completely changed. So, you know, I hope that Netflix and Amazon and all of those outputs really continue to see the value of queer film in that way, and that the filmmakers are being fairly compensated for that.
Well, we're seeing some jump to the fore already. Boy Erased has garnered a lot of fuss already, and rightly so. It's shaping up to be a great film. And then also Rafiki, which you know, is being shown here as part of the lineup. You know, led to Kenya kind of rewriting its rules just to allow the Oscar nominee period of 1 week, which I thought was astonishing. You know, how important is it to play international films as a part of the repertoire of what you show?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly important. Something that, especially in the last few years in Canada, you know, there has been in some spaces an air of, you know, in terms of LGBT rights and representation, you know, Canada is doing quite well. And so, you know, do we really need this space where queer Canadian audiences are seeing, you know, these kind of works where, you know, their lives are generally okay? And I mean, of course, that's a massive generalization. We still have a lot of work to do. But I think it's incredibly critical in Canada and in these spaces where sometimes people can be a bit complacent to show that we are a global community, and there are still many issues that are facing so many folks in so many places around the world, that we really can't forget about. And it also challenges, like, I think, our perceptions of like the narrative form as well, you know, so not all the content we're seeing is, you know, so Western or, you know, one kind of narrative. Having these types of films in the festival can also challenge our audiences, challenge their tastes, challenge, you know, what they think is a good film or a great film,
yeah.
By seeing these other perspectives.
I think those issues that you highlighted to kind of, you know, center us in a kind of a global community, I think we also see them reflected within a very local dynamic. So one of the ones that I'm quite excited to try and catch is Splinters by Tom Fitzgerald, which I think, believe it, this afternoon or this evening. And that's what really struck me was that it was a lady who identifies as bi, and then there's a whole kerfuffle with the family, and then brings back, you know, a gentleman. And it's like, how do you navigate that? And that really speaks to issues around bi erasure, around the bi lived experience, and the challenges that are unique to that community within a rural Canadian context. You know, how do you find gems like that, and what role do they play in terms of the mosaic of the features you have?
I mean, the bisexual representation is so important. And what really excites me about, you know, this film in particular is that its protagonist is so authentic and honest in who she is. And for her, it's not a question. She's not questioning her identity. That's not the journey. It's about how the world around her reacts to her self-assuredness in her identity, which I think is so fascinating. And what's particularly, you know, special for me also about this film is that it is based on a play, a theatrical play, written by an amazing Canadian queer playwright named Leanne Poole. And she wrote the play like 10 years ago. So at that time, no one was really having this conversation publicly about, you know, this real, I mean, authentic bisexual representation. So Tom, you know, optioned the play and then adapted the screenplay and made the film. But it took like 10 years for that to happen.
Wow.
So I love how, you know, we were at the world premiere of the film at TIFF a few months ago, and people's reaction was, oh, it's so forward thinking, it's so fresh, it's so new. And I just love that it's, you know, this woman up there saying, you know, this was my lived experience and I wrote this play 10 years ago. And I think it's taken until now for there to even be a space for this kind of content within even LGBT film festivals, because we do not see a lot of bisexual narratives.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like anything else, I mean, people think they don't exist.
And I'm glad you raised that, because within queer spaces, a sort of hetero-presenting couple, I mean, they get sort of ignored, and I can see how it's taken a long time to push the envelope there. I'm really excited as well about Love, Scott. That sounds like a great film that I'm hoping to see, and the kind of the role it plays in kind of presenting a bit of a realism in terms of rural Canada. And I think that if you're in urban areas, you might become aloof to what happens elsewhere. And I think this may hit home. And do you think Love, Scott maybe is a good fit for those smaller prides who maybe want to tap into their communities and present something where they may be able to better identify?
That's such a great point. We're completely on that page. Like, this is a film that, you know, I think has incredible power because people will see themselves in this film in many ways, in many of the people that are shown in the film, you know, not just necessarily the protagonist and his journey, but, you know, all of the people involved in this rural community and in the you know, the reaction to this tragic incident that happened, and then the strength of, you know, overcoming it. I really think it's an incredibly powerful story for right now. And again, to, I think, kind of combat that idea of Canadian complacency, because we all know, like, there is no one singular Canadian narrative. The life of, you know, a queer person in Toronto is very different than the life of, you know, someone in Moose Jaw. And that is very different from someone in Labrador. And if any of those people have other intersecting identities, whether it's language or cultural heritage or ability, you know, all of these things factor in as well. So I think it's a particularly important film, and I really hope that folks come to see it here in Ottawa. We did an absolutely beautiful screening of it in Toronto with Scott in attendance, and every time I've either seen the film or heard of another festival doing a screening, it's just an incredibly powerful moment, I think, for the whole community that's part of it.
So one of the things that I think is also very timely right now is we had Justin Trudeau's big apology, and we know that the LGBTQ secretariat, through I think Randy Bosanow is MP is involved with that, has been doing a lot of work regarding reconciliation with folks who were ousted from the RCMP, the armed forces, and the civil service. Now, you actually have I think it's a docufilm.
It is.
The Fruit Machine. And for our listeners, we occasionally have to refresh people. It's this barbaric device that the RCMP used to identify homosexuals. And I think Sebastian last week was saying about how, you know, the inventor of it was like, it's not going to work. And they were like, okay, we'll buy two.
Yeah.
And it's just... just so bizarre. But how does this film, do you consider this docufilm to be, how important do you think it is within the context of where we are right now in that reconciliation process with that piece of our history?
I think it's imperative that people see this film. I really, really do. There's so much that I think of our history. I speak as someone who, I grew up in Canada, but also in the US, and what I learned of Canadian history, was quite minimal and really did not even touch on some of these topics that we now know have had massive impacts on the way our culture has evolved. And I think as queer people, we're not taught our history. Like we do have to seek that out, and that's why so many of us learn these lessons from film. But with this film, I think Sarah Fody, the director who's Ottawa-based, has done such an incredible job in, you can just see the intimacy that she creates in these interview situations, what these survivors of this, really purge of queer people from the armed forces and the RCMP, I mean, what she gets them to share through these interviews, it's incredible. It's incredible. And I've been at several screenings of this film, and I'm moved so consistently by it. Sarah mentioned to me, we were at another festival recently, and she said at every single screening, there is someone in the audience who stands up and says, I also was a part of this. And I think we don't even know how deep this really went. Mm-hmm. They say it's maybe 8,000, 9,000 people, but it's such an untold story in Canadian history. I really think people in our community and allies really need to see it.
Well, if you've been affected by the content of that movie, we will have links in our website for the class action lawsuit that is relevant to this, and we will connect you with the lawyers who are taking care of that. And I think this film in particular really brings us all the way back to the start of the conversation about how important it is for folks to see their own history, to see themselves reflected in narratives that are indicative of where they are, but also of their identities they hold. And I sincerely hope that The Fruit Machine and these other films make it into your online catalogue and that other folks can access them. So I sincerely hope so. Well, we'll hopefully have some reviews and some interviews peppered throughout the show, but thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
Absolutely, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Okay, well, I'm so excited and honoured to be able to speak with Jamie and Patty. You're with the group of survivors who were here at the screening of The Fruit Machine. I know that we saw you in the film. What was that process like, being approached? And I think Sarah's ability to have such intense conversations captured on camera is just, it really plays with the heartstrings. From the other side of the seat, what was that process like for you?
It was healing. From the first question, I started crying, and I thought, this is not going to go well. But it was very much healing to tell the story in detail. It's a story I hadn't shared with anyone, my partner, my family. I just didn't talk about what had happened to me. So for me to sit there in front of a room of strangers, we were led so gently, so compassionately through the process that, you told your story and you remembered. And it really has brought a lot of healing in that process.
Now, that remembering must be very painful, but as I think you've just said, it opens it up to healing. What do events like this, with screenings, and you see people
watching and learning, and we had a few younger folks come out and just really express their gratitude. What does that mean in terms of your sort of healing journey?
I think it's a very important step towards that. To see the young people here today standing up and speaking, it really warmed my heart, because this is really what we need to do, is to let the young generations coming up, to have them take this and run with it. Many of us are getting up there in years. It's important that we did this now. And before any more of us pass because of this, we need this story to just reach as many ears as possible, so that this never happens again, ever.
I mean, I think this is without doubt one of the darkest moments in Canadian history that just very much got swept under the rug and ignored, and just almost like it never happened. For us at the CanQueer, we're always pushing to learn our history, learn our culture, and that's extremely important. Now, Justin Trudeau apologized. In fact, our promo features that bit of the apology in our show. But was there enough? Are the steps towards reconciliation helping? Is the citation that's just been revealed? How does that go any way towards helping close that wound?
When this started, it was, to me, I thought the wound had healed. And going through this whole process, the documentary, the apology, meeting up with all these wonderful people and sharing our experiences, it was like ripping open that scar, cleaning it out, and patting it back down. And it's a much healthier experience now. The apology, to me, it meant so much. What's going onward with the memorial, and like Jamie said, to ensure this doesn't happen again, and not just to queer people. It can happen to any minority. Anybody could be targeted, and we need to speak up and ensure that minorities are not put down by others, that we're not suppressed and discriminated against.
Further to what Patty said, also, the wound had healed over, but it had seared in all the pain, the hurt, yeah. And by having that scab that really did need to come off, having that scab removed, like Patty said, the wound was now cleansed with the sharing of our story, for our voices to be heard, for us to become whole.
I think this isn't, an abstract item in a history book. You know, these are real people and real experiences. And I think what this film does is it takes your experiences and it puts them there with no filter on them. And we're right there on the seat right next to you. And I think that's extremely important. And hopefully all of our listeners will check it out and go through what can be an uncomfortable moments in watching that and learning our history, but so vitally important. Now, unfortunately, some folks didn't make it to today. The pain and the consequences of what actions were done by the Canadian government and the Canadian Armed Forces cost people their lives. And I think that we can't lose that. And I'm sure for you folks, that's something that's very real.
Many of us tried to commit suicide after we were released, myself included, and it took a long time to be able to get to a point in my life where I could exist and function on it on a daily level, and I had to push everything down and aside in order to do that. So it's many didn't make it, but many of us tried to not be here. We just didn't want to be here anymore.
And this is Remembrance Day weekend, and so it is especially poignant for us to share this documentary with everyone on this weekend. And Diane Petrie is actually laying a wreath in the parade tomorrow, in honor of those of us who have passed as a result of taking our own lives because of the SIU investigations. And the surviving members who are present here, many of us will be participating in the parade. We'll be marching in the parade. For some of us, it's the first time in 40 years.
Wow.
And so it's quite a profound weekend all around.
I think it's not just for the folks who are marching after 40 years. We had a colonel actually step up and say that he felt that his career was built on a lie because he was better at lying. And I mean, it's astonishing to think that not only an entire generation had been lost to this purge, but there are so many others who squeaked through and having to live with that almost survivor's guilt as well.
Yes, well, absolutely.
Thank you so, so much for taking the time to chat with me. And I will be speaking with Sarah, and hopefully we'll get even more people to see this truly incredible piece of film.
Thank you very much.
And I'm actually here with Sarah Fodi, the filmmaker, and Han Lien, the producer of the film. And wow, I think is my first reaction to that. It was just truly phenomenal. I was talking earlier with Patty and Jamie, some of the survivors, and what I noted to them, and which I'm going to repeat to you now, is what really stuck out to me is your skill at being able to not only just spin the narrative, and the, is a beautifully made documentary piece, but also the skill of getting the folks to open up and tell these incredibly personal and traumatic experiences. You know, I'm sure that when you were getting ready for these interviews, you had an idea of what may come out. Was that difficult for you, kind of coaxing these conversations out of the survivors?
I think it was at the beginning. We had difficulty even finding the survivors, right? Because now they have formed community groups. There's social media groups. There's a Facebook group for the survivors of the purge. That didn't exist when we started our research. So we really had to find people individually. And then once we did and learned a bit of their story, we would schedule, you know, hour, 2 hour long pre-interviews, as we called them, over the phone, and it was in those where Han and I learned the consequences that each individual experienced as part of the purge, and that's really when I think our minds were opened as we were exposed to what they really went through.
And Sarah and I were actually quite lucky that they were willing to share that with us. Because some of these stories, even their families didn't even know about it. So, and as Sarah said, you know, once we had conversations with them over the phone, and then when we got to their place to actually do the filming of the interview, we learned even more information about what had happened, which completely blew us away. And it was quite shocking as well. But we certainly are incredibly lucky to have met these people, and that they were kind enough to trust us to represent or to tell their stories.
One of the things that struck me was I feel like it could have been very easy to vilify the armed forces or vilify the RCMP for having done this. Both Sasha and I have a good friend who was in the military. And she was telling us about how before Donas Don't Tell was lifted, that, you know, they would, lesbians who were suspected would have been sexually assaulted, and there was no recourse to address it. So this chapter in the armed forces history does not lend itself to not being vilified. And I was really surprised at how the narrative note seemed to be that these are folks who wanted to be great soldiers, who wanted to commit, and were maybe stolen of that opportunity, but it was never really set up as a us v them kind of dynamic. Was that a conscious decision?
Absolutely. I think for myself, Han, I won't speak for you, but I think we share this, that the humanity of the story outshone the vilification of the perpetrators. We did, as I mentioned during the Q&A, we tried for several years through Access Information to kind of find those perpetrators, right, both on the RCMP and on the military side. But once we met these men and women, found out what happened to them, and really got a true sense of their spirit, right, and their unwavering commitment, like their nationalism, was so profound that the focus of the film really needed to be giving them a platform to have their voice back, to give them a platform to tell their stories, and to leave the more investigative or, you know, that type of storytelling. Leave that to another filmmaker, perhaps. So I hope that story gets told. I think that it needs to be told, but it's not something that we wanted to pursue ourselves.
Now, we've spoken to Andrea Wilson here at Inside Out talking about the initiative to get these LGBT films out into more communities. You know, if we're in Bonnie Bay, Nova Scotia, or Abbotsford, BC, how do they get to see The Fruit Machine?
I believe the Fumushi, it aired on TVO for about 3 times, and then I believe that you can watch it online as well at tvo.org. We are hoping to get further distribution for the film, but that's obviously just in the works now. And but we certainly want to get this into schools specifically. We've had a number of people come up to us after screening saying that this needs to be taught in history classes across Canada. So that's certainly an avenue that we're trying to explore right now.
Yeah, and just further to that, we're very accessible even as a company. So we encourage people to reach out and find out how they can bring the film into their own communities or workspaces. We're very receptive to that.
So we were talking earlier to the survivors, and they were talking about how this film is acting as an integral tool in their healing process. You know, these screenings had folks come forward afterwards. As you've moved from city to city presenting this, have you heard from even more folks? Have more folks reached out to you?
Yeah, absolutely we have. And, you know, the story is truly an onion, if I can use that metaphor. But every city we travel to and every conversation that we have, it seems like another layer of that onion is revealed to us. There are stories that involved the children of the identified or suspected members, as Han alluded to during the Q&A. That's a story. There's a story evolving around how gay men were targeted around the HIV issue, right, and being tested against their will by the government. I mean, there's just so many stories to this campaign. Again, I just encourage other filmmakers, whether they identify within the LGBTQ plus community or not, to step forward and to tell these stories because they need to be told.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. And like I said, I sincerely hope that everybody who can gets out to see this film. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
When I was a young boy, I was scared of growing up. I didn't understand it, but I was terrified of love. Felt like I had to choose, but it was out of my control. I needed to be saved, I was going crazy on my own. It took me years to tell my mother I expected the worst. I gathered all the courage in the world. She said, I love you now. I just want you to be happy and always be who you are. She wrapped her arms around me, said, don't try to be what you're not, 'cause I love you no matter what. She loves me no matter what. I got a little wishing all my time away, riding on the pavement, every sunny day was gray. I trusted in my friends, then all my world came crashing down. I wish I never said a thing, 'cause to them I'm a stranger now. Well, I ran home, I saw my mother, written on my face. Felt like I had a heart of glass about to break. She said, I love you no matter what. I just want you to be happy and always be who you are. She wrapped her arms around me, said, don't try to be what you're not, 'cause I love you no matter what, yeah. Now I'm a man and I'm so much wiser. I walk the earth with my head held higher. I got the love that I need, but I was still missing one special piece. But Father, father looked at me. He said, I love you, no matter what. I just want you to be happy and always be who you are. He wrapped his arms around me, said, don't try to be what you're not, 'cause I love you no matter what. He loves me no matter what. And they love me no matter what.
Hello and welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media.
I'm Sebastian.
And I'm Luke Smith. And phenomenal films. I want to just quickly mention about The Fruit Machine. Right. I watched it. It was just, it makes you cry. It makes you sit at the edge of your seat. It makes you laugh multiple times. Like the intensity of the documentary. Because it was a powerful documentary. And we spoke to some of the incredible survivors, you know, about the fact that people attempted suicide. Mm-hmm. And many people didn't survive the purge because of the impact it had in their lives.
Yeah.
You know, I would so strongly recommend to every Canadian LGBT person and LGBT folks from across the world, including Botswana and Sweden, you know, check out The Fruit Machine.
In Maryland. Yes, but, living in Ottawa, I've had experience to meet some of the people who've been through that period in history. Unfortunately, I couldn't see the documentary because I was incredibly sick and I slept through it. But what I did do is later on, you and I watched
Rafiki
together.
Yeah.
It had that beautiful balance that you get from a Greg Araki film where it, at the same time, it looked really slick and cinematically really well put together, but it also looked very like rustic and
it looked authentic.
Yeah.
It looked undeniably authentic.
Independent. That's the word I was looking for. Like a really intelligent, independent filmmaker. The use of color was amazing.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Like, we were distracted. Like there were scenes where we were like, I don't remember what happened. It was just all that purple. But yeah, and the story itself I found was a really good balance. It wasn't... I mean, you want a happy ending? But if the ending is too happy, you can't buy it. Mm. So it had the right amount of tragedy where you could believe it. And it wasn't preachy. It had a very show, don't tell. Like it dealt with some very heavy issues. And it dealt with them by demonstrating them and just showing people living through it. And there was no moment where someone turned to the camera and had their little monologue. There was none of that. It was fantastic. It was really well put together. And I think that's the kind of cinema that I would definitely like to see more of. And also it was in three languages.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, Rafiki has, you know, it was banned in Kenya. Yeah. It was unbanned for a total of a week just so that, you know, it could get the Oscar buzz. And, you know, and we've talked about the impact this film has had. And now having seen it, I can see why. Watching it as a Westerner who's seen a lot of gay movies, I'm like, okay, within 20 minutes, you're bought in, you're buying in, you're like, okay, I'm here, I'm in the story. You know, there's two ladies, they like each other. You're totally there, you're on that page. But as a gay Westerner, I'm like, okay, now I'm just waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, okay, when's the gay bashing going to happen? Or when's the bad news going to turn up? You know, when's the thing, everything, you know, this beautiful picture going to fall apart?
Yeah.
Because gay movies in the West for a long time had that almost cliche story arc of lovey, 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 dovey, tragedy, death, end of movie. And a part of me was like, I am disappointed by that. But at the same time,
it's what's needed.
What struck me is how authentic it is.
Yeah. But also just the universal human experience to a certain degree, because there's certain things that at the beginning of the movie, and this was just me being like, okay, from everybody that I've met during my actual life, okay, it's going to be the mom who disapproves and the dad's going to be like, I don't get it, but whatever, you're my daughter. Because most of the women I know, when they came out, it was their mothers they had problems with. And dad was like, hey, that means you're not dating boys and I hate boys because boys are terrible because I'm a boy and I know what they're like. Mm. Like my brother told me he would have loved to have had a lesbian daughter because he wanted to have a daughter, but he wanted her to be lesbian so he didn't have to worry about boys. And I was like, all right. But yeah, and there was a whole bunch of stuff in there that it's like, okay, this is everywhere in the world I've been, and everyone that I've met from around the world, they've had similar experiences. Mm-hmm. So it kind of did tap into that universal human experience.
It was
as well.
Very genuine.
Yeah, for sure.
I think you could tell the dynamics between the actors and well, the characters were mm-hmm. so well portrayed by the actors that mm-hmm. It didn't feel like a kitschy indie film where the acting's like so-so. It was very well made, and bought in.
I watch a lot of independent cinema, and I would say it was just a good example of what independent cinema can be. Although, actually, I've seen quite a bit of African cinema, and that's the first thing I've seen from Kenya. And I've heard good things about Kenyan cinema before, and now I can see, like, if this is an exemplar
of that.
That's
the standard.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, absolutely.
Then, yeah, I would absolutely love to see more.
Well, we would strongly recommend Rafiki. Rafiki, absolutely brilliant movie, and we strongly recommend it, mm-hmm. you know? And I feel like we've had fair critiques of it, and we hope our listeners feel a little bit more informed. Now, we have run out of time. And
have
there's
we?
Other things. I did want to just mention, we have been following the Tanzania story. And the last thing I'm going to note is that the 10 men were, according to the Associated Press, subjected to anal examinations. The Thomas Reddins Foundation has also reported that apparently the 10 men who were arrested in Zanzibar have been released on bail. So we will keep an eye on it. But that's it. We've all got time for.
All right. Well, it's been... been good being here with all of you.
Yeah, I've been Luke Smith.
I'm Sebastian, and thank you for listening.
These days, love comes quick. Find a date, but just stay clear. All it takes is dinner for two, then they're moving in with you. I was raised on country things, slow walks and front porch swings. Got someone who likes my pace, and that's fast enough for me. Everybody's trying to get her done, and I'm just here lying in the sun. A long slow kiss on a sandy beach, and that's fast enough. Fast enough, a sunset drive in my old Jeep, my baby's hand upon my knee. Well, I don't know what you might like, but that's fast enough for me. Try to tame the corporate beast. Don't interest me the least. I got a seed and a row to hoe, and a little love is gonna make it grow. Got enough to get me by, like the taste of humble pie. Got a job at Joe's Garage, and that's fast enough for me. Everybody's trying to get her done, and I'm just here lying in the sun. A long slow kiss on a sandy beach, and that's fast enough, a sunset drive in my old Jeep, my baby's hand upon my knee. Well, I don't know what you might like, but that's fast enough for me. I was raised on country things, slow walks and front porch swings, a George Strait song on the radio, and that's fast enough for me.